Coming to you from New York City, it's the Friars Club Podcast. Established in 1904, the Friars Club is the birthplace of the celebrity roast and has counted the likes of Frank Sinatra, Jimmy Fallon, Billy Crystal, Barbara Streisand, and Johnny Carson among its members. So come on in for a drink and some laughs with your host, Joe Sibilia.
Hello and welcome to the Friars Club Podcast. This is your host, Joe Sibilia, and today I am talking with somebody who I am very fond of. The name Jamie DuBroy is certainly synonymous with the theater here in New York. She's won multiple Tony Awards. She's a legendary Broadway producer, performer. She hosts Jamie DuBroy and Friends, a live cabaret show, and of course, she also does this on television. And some of the shows she's been involved with include Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, Pretty Woman, Fiddler on the Roof, The Addams Family, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Cinderella, and just about anything, I think, that has been staged between 41st and 54th Street at some point or another. I'm pretty sure. She's one of the most prolific producers, I think, in this business, and her name's Jamie DuBroy. Jamie, it's a pleasure to talk to you today on the Friars Club Podcast. How are you?
I am fine, and thank you for having me.
I thank you for being with me, because you really are an integral part of the history of the Friars Club, being that you are one of the first eight women who was named as members of the Friars Club back in 1988. I'm curious to know, I always like to start off with this question, how exactly you became associated with the Friars Club, and how did you become a part of that storied group of eight women who really made history and broke the gender barrier in the Friars Club?
Not exactly sure, but a couple of friars put me up for membership, and in those days, they handed you a hard application and it said, do not type. Well, it would be, or maybe it said it must be, maybe that's what it was. It had to be typewritten, but it was like a hard cardboard, not super hard, but it was harder than to get into a typewriter. And I'm like, how the hell am I going to get this into a typewriter to type it? So I kept waiting and waiting. I could have been the seventh, you know. And I finally said, screw this, I'm going to fill it out by hand. I defy them to, you know, figure this out. And then they ended up doing an article in the New York Times on the first seven women members, and I was the eighth. So I don't know if it was because my application was, you know, came in a little bit later, or they just looked at this list and said, you know, seven is plenty. Because it was people like Joan Rivers and Liza Minnelli and Angelica Houston and, you know, kind of big names, of which I was not a big name. So I figured it, you know, it was one or the other.
Well, you've certainly made a name for yourself in the years since then, if you weren't already a big name. And I think you were, in my opinion, you were at that time. Now, of course, you are what they would call a regular member of the Friars, or you were named as a regular member when you joined. There were other women, obviously, Carol Burnett, Elizabeth Taylor, Barbara Streisand, Barbara Sinatra, Martha Raye, Dinah Shore, several who were named honorary members. Is it almost better to be made a regular full-fledged member, in your opinion, as opposed to have been named an honorary member, where you're sort of, you know, you don't have to go through all the hoops, you sort of had to stake your claim in the club by going through the regular admissions process?
Well, I don't think so. When you're that big of a name, they're not going to, like, put you through an interview and stuff. I mean, I was interviewed, and it, you know, went well. And but, you know, I hadn't gotten the official word yet, and I was upstairs. They tell you can, you know, use the club in the meantime. And I was upstairs in the bar, and somebody introduced me as the latest female friar. And I said, wait a minute, I haven't gotten the official word yet. And he said, well, you didn't blow the interview, did you? And I said, oh, was I supposed to? It was like, he said, with that line, you're in. You know, probably today we couldn't even get away with saying that, which I just did say. But, you know, you can't joke like you can, like you could, let's put it that way. Well, I think things have gotten a little more strict, I guess, about what you can and cannot say anymore.
Well, you mentioned that you had a couple of Friars who sponsored you. Do you remember who the Friars were that put you up for membership when you joined the club?
Ron Cohen, who had printed all these T-shirts for me when I was at Reno Sweeney. And he said, your poster is so great, we should make a T-shirt out of it. So we printed these fun T-shirts with my, it wasn't really my face. It was a little bit of my face from the side and a hat. And it said Jamie DeRoy. And I mean, I never sold them. I just gave them away. I'm sure they made great rags for people. But it was fun. And the other one was George James, who was married at the time to someone I knew, but she was not into the Friars at all, but he was. And he recently died, which is, you know, sad. We've lost so many people lately. It's just, you know, heartbreaking.
It's very sad, you know, as the years go by, we lose so many of the Friars. Just recently, of course, we lost Freddie Roman, and Stewie Stone passed away not too long ago. So it's, you know, and that's a big part of doing this podcast, is trying to preserve the legacies.
And Mousy Lawrence, oh my God.
Right.
He was one of the funniest people I ever knew. Well, I think we still quote his line, Falada. It's Falada. You know, when he in Catskills, that somebody would, you know, take the bread from the table and stick it in their purse. What are you doing? It's for later.
He was really funny. And, you know, you worked with a lot of the funny people who were members of the Friars for many years. I know you opened for a long time Friar by the name of Gene Baylos when you were doing your cabaret act back in the day. What do you remember about working with him?
Oh, my God. He was so funny. He would start his act. I opened for him at the Living Room, and he started his act with his mouth stuffed with chiclets that he cut up in a, you know, a little, I think, I don't know, maybe in half or quarters, I don't know. And he said, I'm sorry, I was a little late tonight, but I just came from the dentist. And then he started spitting these chiclets like it was his teeth. And it was so funny. I just always remember a minute, and at the time I lived on West 72nd over a Chemical Bank. Remember, it was Chemical before Chase. And he said, isn't that singer great? Her assets over $1 billion. And because I lived over a bank.
That's great. And then you also opened for Joan Rivers. Now, how did you first come to meet Joan Rivers, and what were sort of the ground rules for you to perform with Joan Rivers when you were her opening act?
Well, I would see the opening acts for her, which were always singers, both in L.A. and in New York. And I noticed that people would kind of talk through the opening act, that they, you know, they were there to see Joan Rivers and they could care about some singer that was coming on. I mean, it was a great opportunity for any singer, but they really weren't given the attention that they were due. When I, in 1980, like the spring of 80, I moved out to LA. I didn't know really for how long. I was told, oh, you should go out there and become a second banana on a TV show, which of course is easier said than done. And so when I got out there, I thought, well, one job I really could do would be to open for Joan Rivers. So I got Irvin Arthur's was doing the booking, and he sent a young agent to see me at the Belly Room, which was above the Comedy Store in West Hollywood off of, you know, right above, it was on Sunset Boulevard. And it was above the Comedy Store in the sense it was, you know, upstairs. And it was, the Belly Room was for women comics. Well, I was never a stand-up comic. I only did funny songs. I never had the guts to try to really become a full-fledged stand-up comic. I could talk and be funny, but the minute that I felt lost or uncomfortable or something, you know, didn't get the laugh that I was hoping for, or as big a laugh as it did the night before, whatever, I could just break into my next song. So I put together an entire show of just comedy songs. And this young agent by the name of Eric Gold came to see me, and he said to me, well, you could open for Joan, but you can't do any of the funny songs. And I said, Eric, my whole act is funny songs now. I don't want to go back and do straight singing, because you know what? There's so many singers that are way better than I am, and I want to go the comic route. So if that's not what you want, then it's not a job for me. And he went back to them, and they came back with, you know, oh, absolutely, let her do funny songs. So the first night that I opened for her at the LA Improv, I saw Edgar, her husband, Edgar Rosenberg, walking towards me. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm in trouble, because I did get a lot of laughs because the material was quite funny. And I thought, I'm getting fired. And he came over and he said, Joan loved you. She said it was the easiest time she ever walked on stage. So you just take that comedy as far as you'd like. You just go with it, honey, and have fun. And I did. And it was wonderful. I loved working with her. And by the way, this young agent, Eric Gold, went on to become the manager for Jim Carrey. So he had quite a career, you know, in front of him after he and I worked together. He really made it big, and also became his executive producer.
Everything comes full circle in this business, you know? One day,
oh, yeah.
One day you're sweeping the floor, the next day you're running the studio.
And that's why they say be nice to everyone. And speaking of sweeping this floor and running a studio, when I was young and in New York, I started making men's neckties because my sister-in-law made a tie once for my father. And I always thought my older sister-in-law, my older brother's wife, you know, did everything better than I did. And I had to do something that she could do. So I started making ties, and it just sort of snowballed. And I really made a lot of them. And I gave one to my friend Sid Davidoff, who at the time was the deputy mayor for Mayor Lindsay. And he said to me, do you have more of these? And I said, Sid, whatever you want, just pick out the ties you want and they're yours. And he said, no, I was thinking that you could bring them down to City Hall and I'll send you around the offices with my assistant Squirt, which I did.
Oh, I know who this is.
Squirt turned out to be Jeffrey Katzenberg.
That's right.
And he certainly made it big.
Yeah, running Disney and now DreamWorks. You know, he's one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. How about that?
I know. And such a nice guy with me. I mean, we had such a good time. I got into everybody's office except Mayor Lindsay, because he was really busy. And, you know, sometimes I'd go and they'd say, come back in 10 minutes, you know, whatever. Once I went down there with my puppy, I had gotten a new Shih Poo by the name of Shadow. And I went into Jay Kriegel's office and he said, I had to go to the ladies' room. He said, well, leave the puppy with me and put the puppy on the desk. When I came back, he said she peed on all these memos to Lindsay. I said, well, she is paper trained.
That's great. And Mayor Lindsay, again, everything ties back to the Friars Club. He was a participant in the Friars Club. And of course, if you go online, you can watch Johnny Carson when they did the Friars Craft Music Hall roast. And Mayor Lindsay is on the panel. And he was quite funny. He was quite an entertaining guy.
I wanted to be here very much tonight, not only because I'm a friar, not only because I admire Johnny's talent, and not only because I'm fond of him as a human being, but because in my business, where you can lose your job by only one vote, it's silly to take chances. As mayor of this city, I feel it's my duty to tell you of the many wonderful things that Johnny has done for New York. For instance, he goes to Las Vegas several times a year. Actually, he really does very many generous, civic-minded things for New York City. I just wish I could think of one moment.
What a handsome and personable guy he was. Yeah. I mean, I really loved him. And, you know, he brought the film industry back to New York. And at one point, I don't remember who it was that honored him, but some big group honored him for bringing the film industry back. And Sid Davidoff had a table at this benefit, and he invited me. And we're looking around, and everybody, maybe it was at the Hilton or something like that, everybody seems to be getting their dinners but us. So everybody's in black tie. Sid Davidoff looks around the table to the men. He says, "Guys, follow me." He put a napkin over his arm, and they walked into the kitchen, and each man grabbed two dinners, and they brought them to our table. So we got served faster, because we would have been waiting for a long time to eat. It was really clever of him.
That's a great story. Talking about some of the people in the Friars Club, I wanted to ask you, I had read something about you wound up at Sammy Davis Jr.'s house. How did that happen?
Well, some people were waving to me to join them at the Polo Lounge, and I ended up joining them. They ended up taking me to dinner, and we ended up going to Sammy Davis's house. He was on the Tonight Show that night. So he said, you know, come on, we're going to go downstairs, watch my thing on the Tonight Show, and then we'll come back up, which we did. And I mean, it was just the most fun night I've ever had. But my car was back at the Beverly Hills Hotel where the Polo Lounge was. And so this one guy drove me back to the hotel. And as I was getting out of the car, I said, I have to thank you for what a night. I started off this night with not much to do except to have drinks with, you know, my friend D, who got drunk so fast. And then for me to end up at Sammy Davis Jr.'s house. And he said, well, we have to tell you, we loved you. Sammy loved you. But when we motioned to you, we actually weren't motioning to you. We were motioning to the maitre D. So I never should have been at that table.
That's funny.
But, you know, one of my favorite Friars when I joined was Alan King would always like hold court at the bar.
Right.
And he would entertain people with these great, great stories and recollections and, you know, old show business and everything. I mean, he was just the best. And he told me his version of how the Friars got started, which I always loved. I was later told that wasn't quite true, but it was a much better story than the true story, if that was the case. That in the early days, George M. Cohan, you know, was a member, as was his father. And his father was and this is before the Friars Club got formed. I think it was down at the Players Club. And so one day George M. Cohan's senior gets drunk and he takes his cane and he knocks all of the bottles off of the bar. And so they suspended him. And Cohan was going crazy because his father kind of lived at the Friars in the sense of he was there all day hanging out, having fun. Now he's hanging out at home and George can't get any writing done. So he went back to the club and begged them to take his father back. So they said, okay, but he's on probation, one more episode like the last one and he's out. So, you know, he promised to be good. First day he's back, somebody comes over and says, Mr. Cohan, we've missed you. Where have you been? And he said, oh, I was on suspension. Suspension for what? And he goes with his cane for this. And he does it again. And so that was it. He was out. And so they said, we have to form our own club.
And it still lives on after 100 plus years. So when you would go into the Friars Club, I'm glad you brought up Alan King and going there and seeing him. Who were some of the people that you liked to spend time with when you would go to the Friars Club?
Well, Jackie Greene was the dean, I guess. Yeah, because Frank Sinatra was the abbot, and Jackie Greene was the dean. And he would hold court in that upstairs bar. There was a big table, and, you know, a lot of the guys would just sit with him. And, you know, one day he said, "Jamie, join us." And I was like, "Oh my God, I finally made it. I'm at Jackie Greene's round table here, just getting to hear all the stories." And downstairs in the dining room at lunch, there was what they sort of called the bachelor's table. And what was nice about it was that if you didn't have somebody to have lunch with, they seated you at that table, because that table was all people that were on their own. But again, because I was so early into the club, and, you know, most of the women in those days didn't show up at the club at lunchtime, you know, if ever. And so I was one of the few members that was like showing up, but I didn't feel comfortable and enough as a woman to go and say, "Can I sit with you?" Or the maitre d', you know, for him to say, the maitre d' was the famous Frank. You know, he finally said to me one day, "Are you alone?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I'll put you at the bachelor's table." And I said, "Really?" He says, "Of course." So, you know, it might have been my own head that was afraid to ask to sit there. And I just heard some of the funniest stories. There was a guy, Harold Rand, that had so many funny stories that when I started to do my live shows in 1990 at what was then called Steve McGraw's, that morphed into, with, you know, under renovation, the Triad, I brought him onto the show as a guest and just to be like a normal person that told stories. Well, he got so excited about coming onto the show to tell stories that he sort of made it into like a stand-up comic act. And he was really, really great. I mean, there was just one story that he told about. He was on an archaeological dig at Leonard's of Great Neck, and they dug up these bones, and they were trying to identify them. And he says, "They knew they were Jewish because the jaw bones were still moving." He had been a press agent. He was around show business, but he certainly wasn't a performer. But I think I kind of started him on this sort of amateur performing gig that he would go into nursing homes after this, and he would entertain. I mean, he's not going to get hired. He wasn't getting hired at comedy clubs and stuff, but there were nursing homes. They loved him because he just knew old show business. And he had all these old stories. And even if it didn't have to be jokes, really, he could just tell stories. I loved, 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 you know, hanging out with him and a lot of other friars that were just really funny and just fun to be around, you know.
You were at so many of the different Friars events over the years. I know you were at the Tony Bennett Entertainment Icon Award ceremony in 2016. I think I saw you at the Tracy Morgan Award ceremony last May.
Right.
Do you have a favorite of all of these different testimonials and roasts and what have you over the years? What were some of the other ones that you got to go to?
Well, I mean, they roasted Richard Pryor, and Robin Williams was the MC. And I'll never forget Robin's opening line, which was, "How do you roast a man that's already roasted himself?" It was after he set himself on fire from freebasing.
Right.
And it, you know, everybody knew the story and it was so horrible, but, you know, he still kept his sense of humor. And I mean, that was one of the more memorable ones. once women were allowed into the club, they weren't sure whether they should allow them into the roast, but I think they realized that they couldn't not allow them into the roast. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But a lot of women that went, you know, were kind of put off. I took my father one year when I was on the dais. I mean, I never performed, but a couple years I was lucky enough to be on the dais. And so I could bring my dad this one year as a guest. And he said, "What about your mother?" I said, "Oh, I don't think that's a good idea." But even my dad, who grew up telling me his version of dirty jokes were never that dirty, you know, they were risque, but they were not dirty at all. And by the way, before I ever joined the Friars, and this goes back so many years, I knew this guy, Dennis Stein. Dennis Stein at one point was engaged to Elizabeth Taylor, and he had been a longtime friar. And somehow or other, he got a black market audio tape, because they certainly didn't have, you know, even you couldn't videotape even if you wanted to in those days. But somebody snuck in an audio recorder, and he came over to our mutual friend's Richie Dworkin's house, and we were sitting around with a bunch of people, and he says, "I have to play you something." And it was a roast for Humphrey Bogart. And there was a lot of very low humor that most of the comics were saying, but Maurice Chevalier gets up there and says, I do not get that these people are saying these terrible things about my friend Humphrey Bogart. He is such a terrific man. I love this man. There's not enough good things I could say about Humphrey Bogart. So to you, on this day of your honor, here's to you, you old cocksucker." And somehow when you say it in French, it doesn't sound so bad.
That's a good way of putting it.
But one of my favorite friars, and somebody I used often both at the Friars and in my shows in the various clubs, was Kevin Meaney, who we lost way, way, way too young.
Yes. People may remember him best for portraying Uncle Buck on the television adaptation of the film.
Right. And even before he did anything like that, I mean, he just was this terrific comic. And he always killed. So, and he brought a little music to the thing, and he did that We Are the World, where he just with like glasses and a bandana, he could imitate, he lip sang to We Are the World, but he imitated everybody on it. And it was just, you know, one after another, after another, after another. And so it was also easy for him to do because it was on a tape. So you didn't have to have a piano player to do it, you know. And it was one of the most brilliant pieces of material ever. But I remember doing one of my shows with him on the show upstairs at the bar level. You know, we did it in the bar. What was that? Was that the Ed Sullivan Room?
The Milton Berle Room? Are you thinking of the big
Milton
room?
Milton Berle Room. Yeah, the upstairs. So anyway, I stupidly leaned down to stretch and sort of touch the floor, and I got super, super dizzy. And, you know, later I found out I had this thing called benign postural vertigo. But I didn't know what I had then, but I just knew that the world was spinning. And I thought, I hope this doesn't happen when I get on stage. So I turned to Kevin and I said, "Listen, if this happens again and I can't do the show, I want you to host. Under no circumstances is this show to be canceled. There's too much great talent. So you take over, okay?" And he said, "You're going to be fine." I went, "Okay, I hope so. But just remember what I said."
That's great.
And I always feel that with my shows. It's sort of like I've put so much work into them even before we hit the stage, that if something happened to me, I'm I'm the hostess. I sing, you know, I started off singing throughout like three songs. I'm down to two numbers now. And you know, tell funny stories in between or something. But I always feel like I put this group together, but God forbid I should trip and break my ankle or something. Somebody should host and let people in, still enjoy this. It should not get canceled because I'm of the school of the show must go on.
Exactly. Exactly. And you've co-produced over 80 Broadway shows and 50 off-Broadway shows. And one of them that you were a producer of was Mr. Saturday Night, which was starring Billy Crystal, who was recently on this show. Now, how exactly did you become involved with the musical production of Mr. Saturday Night?
Well, I mean, the Nederlanders were producing it. And, you know, I kind of went after it because I was a big Billy Crystal fan. And we started like before the, I'm trying to think, we were supposed to go much earlier than we did. And then the pandemic hit. We were supposed to follow the Lehman trilogy into the Nederlander theater, but the pandemic hit and Lehman trilogy was shut down, as was everything. And the set stayed on stage and we kept thinking what's going to happen. And I was involved with both of these. And I kept thinking, well, even if, you know, that Billy would be much better off anyway to start later than rather than right when we came back, whenever that was going to be, because nobody knew then. Listen, when this happened, we thought it was going to be 2 weeks. But luckily, they were able to extend the Lehman trilogy. They recast one of the roles, and they, after the pandemic, they re-upped, they postponed Billy Crystal, Mr. Saturday Night. And listen, even with the postponement, there was still COVID problems. And so you can imagine if it had happened even earlier, that it would have been much worse. I mean, I loved Mr. Saturday Night. I thought Billy Crystal was just brilliant. But had COVID not happened, so many of these shows, you know, would have had all of them a more, you know, more successful runs. And certainly Mr. Saturday Night would have. I mean, listen, even Billy got COVID and we had to lose a bunch of performances because in those days, I think you had to like be out 10 days at the beginning.
Right.
Oh, it's a little shorter, but, you know, you can't really replace Billy Crystal. It's the problem with, you know, with having such a big star. Now, if they ever did it on the road, yes, they will put somebody else in that role. But they're not expecting Billy Crystal. You know what I'm saying? You come to a Broadway show with the headliner, Billy Crystal, you expect to see him. So it would be very hard to put the understudy in as a replacement.
It really was a great show. I got to see it, and I just loved it. And it was a very Friars-centric show. You know, it was a great to see the Friars Club recreated on the stage. It was it really was a lot of fun.
God,
so I commend you.
It was terrific. And you know, of course, the idea. You know, we so many ideas and thoughts of having, you know, special functions and special events at the Friars with Billy and, you know, some of the cast, but because of COVID, they could never happen. And you know, listen, even still today, they are afraid in many cases to take their stars and let them do special events outside of the theater. The whole thing with talkbacks these days is almost a thing of the past because they're just afraid to get the star sick. Nobody can afford to. So it was.
I didn't get that.
Now my iWatch is talking to me. I never talked to her, but she always is talking to. She told me I couldn't use something about using a bad word or bad language, and I hadn't sworn. And I thought, wow, she should hear me when I do swear.
That's too funny.
It's like she yelled at me for, I don't even know what I said, but it wasn't remotely bad.
I'll have to bill your watch as a guest on the podcast. I saw a great photo of you with Jerry Lewis, who was the longtime abbot of the Friars Club. What do you remember about meeting Jerry Lewis, and especially the Jerry of the later years?
Well, not that he would remember me, but I actually met Jerry Lewis in Vegas. I was flying to Vegas with two of my friends that worked for William Morris, and I knew, oh God, what was his name? He was the partner of Mushalem Ricklis, for the liquor company, whatever it was called. Anyway, he found out I was going to Vegas, and he said, "You know, you can fly on our private plane there if you want. I can't fly you guys back." But I went with Tom Ilias and Fred Moss. So the three of us flew on this private plane. There might have been another person from William Morris with us, I'm not sure. Izzy Becker was his name.
Right.
And he was a friar. So and I'll think of the liquor. Was it Shenley? I think it was Shenley.
That sounds right.
So anyway, he flew us on the plane, which was fabulous. But he said, "You can't touch the food. It's for Pia Zadora and her trip back." And the food was like this fruit salad that was made into the shape of a bird that was so beautiful. I mean, the food was like, we didn't have iPhones then. I would have taken pictures with my iPhone if we had them.
And Mushalem Ricklis, by the way, was married to Pia Zadora at the time, if you don't know, if you're listening.
Exactly. And that's why she could afford to fly back and forth on a private plane. So anyway, the guys had Jerry Lewis at one of the hotels. So we went to see Jerry Lewis's show. And after the show, we went to his dressing room. And Jerry Lewis had hanging in his dressing room six tuxedos, six tuxedo shirts. He opened his drawer of brand new socks to show us. And he said, "I never wear a pair of socks twice. I wear them once and I throw them away." And I was thinking, somebody's going through his garbage and taking those nice socks home and washing them. I certainly would. But I had also met him many, many, many years before that, because I ended up working on the Golden Globe Awards as a stand-in. And his director, Bobby Finkel, was the director of the Golden Globe Awards. And I think Jerry presented, and I got to meet, you know, a zillion stars that day, including Dustin Hoffman and Andy Williams and John Wayne. And I mean, everybody, it was like amazing. It was the year that Midnight Cowboy was nominated. So we were told, we were there for camera rehearsal. This was in LA. And I was on the way to the airport when Bobby Finkel said, "Do you want to do this?" And I said, "Yeah, but my suitcase is in the car. I was going to take a plane to San Francisco, so I have to tell my aunt and uncle I'm staying longer." They probably thought, "Oh, we're getting rid of her finally." So anyway, they said, "Look, if your name is called of the person you're standing in for, because we do not call the real winner, we don't know the real winner. But if your name is called, you can go up and make the speech." So Dustin Hoffman came to the table to see where he was going to be. And that's where I first met Dustin. And I said, "Well, if they call your name, do you want to go up and do your speech?" He said, "No way. I'm not jinxing myself. You go." So his name was called and I got to go up there. And I remember standing between John Wayne and Andy Williams, and Andy Williams was standing on a box so he wouldn't look so short next to John Wayne. And I don't remember what I said. I just remember what somebody else said. And all these people, the other stand-ins besides me, were dancers on the Jerry Lewis show, and dancers, I think, on the Andy Williams show. They were dancers from shows that Bobby Finkel had something to do with because he knew them all. So one dancer gets up there to make the speech and starts going on and on about da-da-da-da-da. And to those of you who didn't win, well, that's showbiz. You know, something you could never say on camera. It was just great, great fun. But I think that day, you know, somebody, probably Steve Zorikoff, was, you know, running around with a camera all the day, probably just, you know, I got to take a picture with him. But we didn't have that much interaction usually with Jerry Lewis. We had much more interaction with Alan King and Freddie Roman and Dick Capri, you know, and people like that, you know.
Who were in New York more often or lived in New York.
Yeah, that were at the club a lot. And Dick Capri was so funny because I think he did my show when I was at Don't Tell Mom It. And, you know, he had that setup about, you know, I've played Carnegie Hall. I've played this one. I've played. And now my career is made because I'm playing Don't Tell Mama.
Well, yeah, you have had quite the career, Jamie, and I want to talk a little bit about your show before we go that you are the host of, Jamie DeRoy and Friends. How exactly did this show get started, and where can people watch the show on television?
Well, on television, you kind of have to be in New York, or if you live out in East Hampton, it plays there. And I can't even remember the days it plays it. You know, we send it, and then they put us on the schedule every time. Which is not always the same days, but it plays so much that if you flip, or I guess if you put Jamie DeRoy and Friends in your DVR, it will find it. In New York, it's on 1993. My very, very first Jamie DeRoy and Friends, which we started at Steve McGraw's. We had wonderful guests. I mean, I had Laverne Baker, who was a Friar, by the way.
Right.
I had Freddie Roman. I had Dick Capri. I had so many great people. But on the third week, and I was doing it every week at Steve McGraw's, and we just happened to be videotaping. The third week, Steve Allen showed up.
Wow.
Steve Allen had been sending me all of his songs and parodies that he wrote. And he had just sent me this song, Gorillas in the Mist, was a big movie at the time. So he sent me this song, and I was thinking of even doing it that night. And I had the lyric written there, and we had the music. Steve Allen shows up in the audience. So before the show, I said, I don't want to put you on the spot, but would you want to come up and do the song? And he said, well, I sent it for you to do. And I said, I know, but I think people will get a much bigger kick out of you doing it. And it was Gorillas in the Mist set to Strangers in the Night, you know, Gorillas in the Mist. So he gets up and he does it. It was just magical. And right before the show started, Barry Mitchell at the time was my co-host. He ran up the street, and we were on 72nd Street, and he ran up to the deli, and it was, which was a real, I don't know, remember, it was a Shapiro's or what the deli was called, but it was on 72nd Street, and he got a big salami, which Steve Allen used to give away these salamis on his shows, and he called them Louisville Sluggers. So at the end of the show, we presented him with the salami. And I mean, he just got such a big kick out of it. It was just incredible. And it was so much fun. And he gave us, you know, permission to air it when we, you know, shortly after this, we went on to TV. And, you know, he kept sending me all these songs over the years. After Steve McGraw's, I moved to Caroline's. And then at one point I moved the show to Don't Tell Mom, and all over the city. So we were at Don't Tell Mom at this point, and Henny Youngman showed up. And I brought him up from the audience, and he just got up there and did the most solid 6 minutes of funny, funny, funny one-liners. And, you know, we would show that on the air. I mean, you know, to have Henny Youngman on tape, you know, doing, you know, I just went on a business trip, took my mother-in-law to the airport, you know. I mean, I met a hooker. She said, I'll do anything for $50, wash my windows. I mean, he just, you know, would like just absolutely one after another, just throw them out there. And he was so gracious. And at the end of his act, he said, you know, we know Jamie from the Friars, and we never really knew what she did, but now we do. And it was just so funny. And so special that he would, you know, would do this. So I and a lot of the Friars would be, you know, sometimes they'd say to me, hey, why don't you call me? Yeah. And I would go, I didn't know you'd want to do it. I'll call you anytime.
You put on a great show, and your next live show, I should mention, will be on June 19th. And it's just, I think, tremendous what you do to support so many performers who are both established and up-and-comers. It's a great time, your show.
Thanks. And it's upstairs at Birdland, where we've done many of these benefits for the Entertainment Community Fund, which used to be known as the Actors Fund. And they had changed their name. Nobody knew what they changed it to. Right, they were going to announce it at their benefit, and then the pandemic happened, so they couldn't announce it. And it was only, you know, after things got back on their feet again that they then had another benefit, and they announced it there, which was, you know, a couple of years after they, you know, wanted to do the big announcement. They've changed it because they wanted everyone to know that they didn't just take care of actors, that they took care of everybody from stagehands to ushers to singers in clubs and comedians, and just everybody that's in the entertainment community can be, you know, part of this group. It's one of the best groups I know. That and Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS are the two of my favorite entertainment groups, you know.
You are one of the most charitable people that I've encountered in the entertainment business. And I could talk to you for another hour, Jamie, but I have kept you far too long already. So I should conclude by asking you why you think, after over 100 years in existence, that the Friars brand continues to endure, and it continues to remain so vital and impressive to people both in and outside of show business.
Oh, boy, that's a tough question. I mean, you know, listen, over the years, I think all clubs have taken, you know, a big hit, and, you know, let's hope it endures. You know, I don't take anything for granted. It's like when you think a Broadway show is going to run forever, I say to people, you know, listen, see it. You want to see this show, you buy the tickets as soon as you can, because anything could happen. And, you know, nothing taught us that lesson more than the pandemic. And so I just, it has this aura, and I hope it keeps the aura about it, because it's certainly been a big part of my life. But it, you know, who knows, it could evolve. And, you know, I think a lot of that remains to be seen. It's certainly not in the news as much lately, but we hope that it does continue on and have the vibrancy that it always did. You know, with a new, younger set of people, you know, coming up and running it, because unfortunately, as you see, we're losing all the old Friars.
Well, I'm 27, and I just joined the club last year, and this has sort of been my passion project with the club. I wanted to host a show that was a talk show that was about the Friars Club, because I always watched, you know, The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and that sort of thing, and I always admired those great entertainers. And I love the idea of a talk show where people just sat around and kibitzed, and that's basically what the Friars Club is. It's like walking onto the set of The Tonight Show, and I also wanted to do this to preserve the memories of so many of these great friars while they're still around. And I have to thank you for making time for me because, you know, you're really a benchmark in Friars history, being the eighth woman admitted as a member to the club in New York. It's, you know, it's really not lost on me. You are a true legend of the club, Jamie.
Well, thank you. And, you know, the interesting thing, too, is that I, you know, looking back, I wanted to go to the club with the, you know, when we finally, you know, had the video cameras, which started, you know, I don't exactly know when, but I mean, I wanted to sit down with some of these friars like Alan King and let him tell his stories. You know, I can tell you what he told me at the bar, not all of them, but just like, you know, how the friars started, whatever. But there's nothing like Alan King telling the story, or Harold Rand telling his story, Henny Youngman telling his stories. Any of these people, I wish that we had them caught on camera, because it would have made for a great documentary. And I, you know, unfortunately, I think we missed out on a lot of that.
Well, Jamie, your contributions to this podcast, consider it a little piece of the puzzle of the history of the Friars Club. I'm glad that we're preserving your stories now today as we've been talking. So all I can say is thank you so much for talking with me, because you are truly a delight, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
An absolute pleasure to talk to you, too, and I hope we can do it again, and I hope to see you in person again.
I know, sooner than later. You're really a woman about town. Everywhere I go, any sort of an event, you're there like Johnny on the spot. So I'm sure one of these days we will bump into each other, hopefully sooner than later.
Absolutely. Well, you take care, and great, great, great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Friars Club podcast. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For more information on the Friars Club, please visit friarsclub.com. We hope to see you there.